Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined today by America's leading presidential historian and storyteller, Michael Beschloss, who's out with his new book, Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times. And it's an amazing book, so well-researched and narratively engaging, and a work of history, and it became a bestseller immediately, which is a testament to how much this country thirsts for Michael's work and works similar to this. Michael, jumping into this, the Constitution is the overriding theme throughout this entire book, and you believe the framers would be appalled at the current state of presidential power. They expected the Congress and not necessarily the president to make war. What is it the framers expected of the presidency as it relates to war powers?
They were worried about the fact that in Europe and in England, the way that, kings became much more powerful and tyrannical was to come up with wars that would allow them to unite the country and become more popular and abuse even more power. So that what the framers did was they said, in the United States, if a president wanted a war, he had to go to Congress. Congress had to debate it and pass a war declaration. That was at the beginning of our country. Here we are 200 years later, and presidents now can start wars almost single-handedly, almost overnight. Last time president asked Congress for a declaration was 1942, and Brian, I think we've had one or more, two wars since then.
And that's completely unconstitutional, right?
I think it is. I mean, I feel very strongly about institutions, and the reasons why the founders did that is they wanted to make sure that if we had to go to war and put young Americans in harm's way, it would only be if there was something that was absolutely essential to our national security. And now we're in a situation where any president in modern times, if he wants to do it for political reasons or reasons that may not be supported by a vast majority of the United States, he can do it anyway.
The beginning of the book starts with James Madison during his re-election bid in 1812. What was it about that year and that era that made him such a great founder but a not-so-great president?
Well, he was terrific at the time of the Constitution, but a really weak president, and let himself be pushed into this War of 1812, which was for two purposes: get the British to stop harassing our ships and also conquer Canada. You know, you can argue those aims round or flat, but they didn't have too much to do with our national security. And the other thing, Brian, is if you think about it, I think the War of 1812, not Vietnam, 1812 was the first time we lost a war because we didn't achieve those war aims. And the other thing is that not Vietnam, but the War of 1812, that was the most unpopular war in American history.
You mentioned the war aims, and I always think about this with right now the global war on terror and some of the other wars. How do we know when we won? Because we don't have a clear objective identified. Has that been a problem throughout history?
It has. We rely very much on our presidents to explain to Americans why we're fighting, what the aims are, how many casualties there might be, and what's the definition of victory. And as I show in the book, over 200 years, a lot of presidents have not done that very well.
James Polk is one of these presidents, kind of like a Buchanan, that we don't know much about. And so, as I read in the book, he was really an awful human being. And his conduct leading up to the Mexican-American War, how did it earn him that description?
He was a liar and a bully and a scoundrel, and he devised a fake border skirmish in Texas as an excuse to get us into a war with Mexico that was a major war all the way to Mexico City, although it had a good aim, which is that he was able to basically chisel the Mexicans to give us almost a million square miles, which made us a continental nation all the way to the Pacific.
The thing I like about this book is it's not chapter one, James Madison, chapter two, James Polk, whatever. It's a continuation story. And as you started this book 10 years ago, however long it was in the making, was that really your premise going in, that this is really a continuum of this whole idea of presidential power versus congressional power?
Yeah, that was a theme. And the other thing is I wanted to tell the stories of these eight or nine human beings who've taken America into major wars. They had an experience that no other American has had, and I wanted to see what they had in common. A lot of them had, as you know from reading the book, emotional breakdowns. Every single one of them got more religious under the strain. Lincoln said he couldn't understand how any war president would not become more religious with that kind of trauma. They were all married to strong women who had a big influence on what they were doing, And every single one of them had empathy. For instance, Lincoln was told he had to build a national cemetery, a new one. He said, build it next to my summer house. It'll be very painful for me, but I want to see the Union graves being dug. I want to be confronted every day with the terrible consequences of the decisions I'm making that are leading young Americans to die.
Your book describes Lincoln really in an admirable way during his conduct during the Civil War, although he's subject to criticism throughout history about certain things like suspending the rule of habeas corpus. But why is it you sort of gave Lincoln a pass when he did all of these things?
I gave him a little bit of a pass because he said, if I suspend habeas corpus, for instance, that's because this is a unique situation, an insurrection by all these states of the South. I do not want it to be a precedent for other presidents later on. And the other thing is, I looked very carefully, there was no lust for power in Lincoln. He was not doing this for himself. He was doing it for what he saw as the moral struggle of extinguishing the evil of slavery.
Moving into the 20th century, you know, FDR with World War II, he was subject to some criticism for perhaps not getting into the war sooner, and also the Japanese-American internment camps. Are those criticisms fair of his leadership during that time?
Yeah, I think when he locked up the Japanese-Americans for years in concentration camps, that was a big violation of civil liberties that we should all remember and never do again. Even J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI said it wasn't necessary.
But then, as you look, Harry Truman, his successor, got into the Korean War, and that's really where things started to go awry for modern times as far as seeking congressional approval, right?
Yeah, I love Truman, but in Korea, he was told, all right, you know, you've sent troops to defend Korea against the North Korean invasion. When are you going to go for your war declaration? And Truman said, I don't have to. I like James Polk. He told Congress to go to hell, and I will tell them the same thing. And the result was that when Lyndon Johnson, 14 years later, was looking at Vietnam, they said, you want a war, you should ask Congress for a declaration. Johnson said, I don't have to because Truman didn't ask for one.
And we're talking with Michael Beschloss about his new book, Presidents of War. And if you've never read Michael's work, well, you're in the minority in this country, I would assume, for one. But number two, go out and check him out. My first experience with Michael was reading his books about the Lyndon Johnson tapes, and then I went back and read everything he's written. So he's an excellent presidential historian. Michael, though, as we continue on this, is Congress really to blame in any part for not stepping up? Because I would think, you know, congressional people don't like to make decisions sometimes, and they let the president do this to sink or swim. Is that part of the issue here?
It is a huge problem because members of Congress, especially leaders of Congress, are very worried about criticizing a leader of their own party during wartime. And they're also worried that if they do that, the president will then say, you're not criticizing me, you're criticizing the troops in the field. No one wants to do that. But the most patriotic thing that all of us can do in a democracy is criticize those in power. And the founders felt that the best policy comes from members of Congress criticizing the president, Supreme Court checking excesses of presidential power. The system does not do well when people pull their punches.
And I would think, looking back, the founders probably could never have anticipated the two-party political system that we have now. And as we look at it, was there anything akin to that? Or were these, I looked at the War on Terror as a Republican versus Democrat thing during George W. Bush's term,
right?
Bush 43. Could the founders have even anticipated anything like that, that the war would become so politicized in any form?
Not at all. And I think if they came back, there's no way of predicting, but if they came back, what they would say to congressional leaders in wartime is, make sure you vet and criticize what the president is doing as much as possible, because he's going to make mistakes, and the only people who can save him are all these leaders in Congress.
As you wrote the book, it seems obvious that some presidents read the history of other presidents. Is that something that happens regularly that you found throughout history? Is presidents would study what other presidents did and try to take away from that, or would they take away what they wanted to take away?
The great presidents know history, and I'm not saying facts or dates, Brian. What I really mean is Harry Truman, although he didn't have a college education, was probably the best read president in presidential history. And when he had a big, tough problem like firing MacArthur or dropping the atomic bomb in Japan, he would think back to things that Lincoln or Andrew Jackson had done. not because there was an exact parallel, but at least there was some idea. It would guide him a little bit in making these decisions, always under pressure and always without enough information.
But you've also got advisors there, but advisors are probably the same. You hear what you want to hear, right?
Yeah, advisors are great, but they go on and give advice, and it's the president who has to take the heat.
The thing I love about your books is they're nonpartisan history, and facts are facts. How do readers respond, and maybe other historians respond, when they read something that doesn't satisfy with their own narrative of the president that they happen to like?
Well, I hope that they'll even be more stimulated by it. In the books that I love to read are those that challenge me or tell me something that's different from what I thought before.
Do you go into a book like this with a certain premise in mind and try to either prove or disprove it, or what's that process like?
I went into this one with a real question, which is I wondered how it came to be the case that in my lifetime, Lyndon Johnson was able to take us into Vietnam almost single-handedly and oftentimes not tell the truth about what he was doing. And later on, you know, presidents like George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush were able to get us into major wars, as well-intentioned as they may have been, without very much consultation with Congress. As you know, Brian, there's something now called a resolution. The president could go to a Congress and say, I'd like a resolution for armed force. It's not the same thing as asking Congress to declare war, because the result is, if the war gets unpopular, members of Congress will say, well, I never voted for war. I was just voting to give the president authorization to use our armed forces. And that's sort of a Weasley way that lets them get out of it, and not a great thing for the Republic from my point of view.
Is this the toothpaste out of the tube type of situation, though, the way that this has become used, this war power by the presidency? It'll never go back to a congressional power exclusively?
I think if members of Congress see that this is allowing presidents to get our armed forces into conflicts that they shouldn't be, then they'll look for ways to, you know, turn back the clock, and that's the way our system works, as you well know. We tend to correct things like this, so God forbid that a modern president will get us into an unnecessary war, but as I've written in this book, as you know, there are an awful lot of cases in which that's happened.
This book took you 10 years, I think you've said, to write. And are there points during when you write a book that over that span of time that you think, oh, the book's done, and then think, no, I've got to include more? Or how does that work when you're writing something, you know, and you're having to look back 10 years ago to what you wrote at the beginning?
That was exactly the problem, Brian. I thought this book would take maybe 3 or 4 years, which probably sounds like a long time to most people. But what happened was that since I'm dealing with about 8 or 9 presidents in major wars, I quickly found I couldn't just, you know, read 3 books on each president and go to 3 archives of manuscripts and, you know, or to the National Archives. I had to research every single one of them as if I was writing a separate book on them. And that's what took all the time, but that's the work I love. You know, some people use research assistants in this kind of work, and in my case, if I did that, I'd be giving up a big part of the kind of work I love doing, because you go into a library and you're looking through the letters of some former president, and let's say you intend to look at the letters of McKinley and the Spanish-American War. Well, you begin to look at other letters and other diaries that tell you a little bit about his marriage or about his religion. Those bear on his war leadership, too.
And this book is chock full of little details like that. And the other thing I was curious about before we go is, when you have this book and you put it together, as you sit back and read it, has your opinion changed at all from the premise going in?
Totally. I mean, every single one of these presidents I saw in a different way. Used to respect Madison as a founder. I now think he was a terrible president. Didn't know much about Polk. I'm appalled by the way he lied the country into a war that we didn't necessarily need to fight. Love Lincoln. McKinley, I think, was a little bit of a cipher. Led him to be drawn into this war against Spain over the sinking of the Maine and Havana Harbor, which actually didn't happen. Wilson, I think, did not achieve his aim to get into the League of Nations, and that's a large mark against him, notwithstanding his racism. FDR, with 2 big exceptions, great war leader. Truman, as I mentioned, made the mistake of allowing presidents to get into wars without a congressional declaration. And I love Lyndon Johnson for Vietnam, for Medicare and civil rights, but on Vietnam, sadly, he was one of the worst war presidents in American history.
All right. The book is Presidents of War. The author is Michael Beschloss, and Michael is one of those authors that he's never written anything that I didn't absolutely love, and that's rare for any writer to achieve that status, but it's amazing. Michael Beschloss, thanks so much for joining us to talk about your book.
That's so kind of you, Brian. I'm honored. Love talking.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.